welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. Today we're joined by the one and only Carlos De La Torre. Carlos is regarded as one of the most prolific sales leaders on the planet. Part of the original PTC and Blade Logic alumni, he's gone on and had multiple exits, including MongoDB. In this episode, we talk about what it takes to get from 100 million to a billion in revenue, the importance of nurturing great talent, and how to choose an organization with the best possible exit potential. This is his playbook. Welcome to Hunters and Unicorns. I'm Simon Coutis and I'm joined by my co-host, Ollie Cooney.
Welcome back to the show, everyone.
And it's an absolute privilege to be joined by the one and only Carlos De La Torre. Carlos, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Great to have you back on the show. I think it's probably more to the point, Carlos. And
indeed,
great to be in your hometown of Miami.
Indeed.
As well.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Carlos, you have been on the show before, so we have spoken about your journey, but we were really keen to get you back on because there are some really key topics that we want to go through today with you. But what's so interesting about your career is that you've had the big exits. You've had the big wins. And I want to grab a list. I'm going to grab a list of names, and I just want to read through these names and just ask you, what do you think about this list? So we've got Jesse Green, Graham Moreno, Alex Verrill, Dan Fougere, Joe Morrissey, Jessica Roman, Azam, Lorsch, Bolin, Rapetti, Marcello, McLernan. The list goes on and on. What do these names mean to you?
Oh, it makes me very happy. Those are some amazing people. I would say to describe all of them in at once, these are people who have high potential, a commitment to excellence, the discipline to do the hard work, and people who have whose careers have absolutely blossomed. And I'm so happy and proud of every single one of them. Some great names there.
It is. It's incredible. It's a stellar list. And I think what's really interesting, Carlos, is that this is, it's not just recent success. This is something that you've been doing now for best part of three decades, going back to the Keith Butlers and the Fougeres and Andy Byron, for example. These are, you know, really, really big, well-established CROs. What does it take for you to kind of continue to nurture talent so consistently over such a long time?
I'm not good at a lot of things. I think I've got an idea how to spot talent and how to develop talent, and nothing is more fulfilling, frankly, in my life and in my career. Well, you could say in my life, my family's more fulfilling, but second to that, this is it. What's more amazing than helping someone realize their potential and put their career on a new trajectory and do things with their life that they wouldn't have otherwise been able to do, and things for their family. It's amazing. It's a beautiful thing.
What did you see in those individuals to really think about focusing time on?
I guess I saw a combination of things that together mean that they are people who can deliver outsized value to the organization. So that combination, you know, the things you'd expect, very smart, a willingness to learn, high drive, high work ethic. But, you know, there's a woman, Angela Duckworth, who talks about grit. You're probably familiar with her. And I think she does a nice job of defining grit as the combination of a very strong commitment to a goal and, importantly, and this is the one that so many people miss, a commitment to persevere through the obstacles. And so that willingness to do whatever it takes to be successful, I would say, is a common thread across these people that have gone on to do amazing things. Is, of course, there are going to be obstacles. Of course, there are going to be things that they're not good at. Of course, there are going to be technology challenges and market challenges and all kinds of things. But if there's that commitment to power through it, then they get through it.
What kind of environment do you need to create in order to be able to get the best out of people?
I think you want to have an environment, first of all, of candor, of I talk about radical candor, and I'm committed to it. You have to have transparency. And, you know, ruinous empathy is so common in our society and in the corporate world. Telling people half-truths to save their feelings and to maintain the relationships. And I think that's a travesty, because you deprive people of the gift of knowing what the hell's going on, where they need to change what they're doing or work on themselves. And so first key ingredient is an environment of radical candor, which means you tell the truth, and it's clear that the reason that you're telling the truth is for the good of the individual and for the good of the organization. There is a temptation to fall into what I call the asshole quadrant, which is where you're telling the truth, but it's not obvious that you're telling it for the good of the organization or for the good of the person. Well, that's better than ruinous empathy, but it's not as good as radical candor, because people tend to get defensive. And so ideally, stay in that quadrant of radical candor where you tell the truth and it's clear that the positive that positive intent is there. So that's the first ingredient. Second is you have to have an environment where there's a commitment to growth, where there's a shared view that mistakes, that shortcomings are something to focus on, something to embrace, and something to work on, not something to be embarrassed about, not something to hide and try to dismiss. Because when you've got this culture of leaning in to our challenges, then you're constantly filling in the gaps. Oh, I'm not good at this. Okay, then get good at it. How do you get good at it? By being bad at it and doing it again and again and again. And so that commitment to working on our weaknesses. And of course, you have to have an appreciation to excellence, an appreciation for excellence, a knowledge of what is the best way. And if we don't know, then we'll figure it out. But if we're learning everything on the fly, then certainly it takes a while. And so having an organization or having a team where you have some individuals who have seen excellence and can sort of set the tone and set the example, set the standard for greatness. And then as a team, you move towards that greatness and you have this radical candor, commitment, and then ultimately just working hard. Like there's no substitute for just hard work and perseverance.
In terms of how that can be perceived, that obviously comes with a level of intensity.
Yes.
And having to not let things slide.
Yeah.
And what happens if you don't do that?
Hey, look, greatness is not for everyone, and that's okay. There are many types of greatness. You can be great at other things. You can be great at art. You can be a great, you know, family person. You can be great dog owner, whatever. What I've tried to build and support in my career is organizations that are committed to greatness in sales, in enterprise sales. And of course, with that comes sacrifice, and that's okay. Greatness in baseball doesn't come with lots of practice, and greatness in swimming doesn't come without jumping in a cold pool very often. And so if someone is going to be critical of it, typically it's a situation where they didn't appreciate the commitment, the sacrifices that were required to achieve greatness.
So we see a lot of this in elite sport, in elite anything.
Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that you kind of follow or inspires you, that you kind of map yourself to when you're kind of, or is it just innate in terms of?
You know, something that I've heard, I'm not an expert in Kobe Bryant, but I have heard about Kobe that he was a student of multiple disciplines. He would learn about all sorts of various things and find opportunities to bring truths or lessons from other disciplines into sports. I believe the same is true in sales. The Buddhists have a saying that the universe exists in a grain of sand, meaning by studying any single thing deeply, all the knowledge, all the truths of the universe become exposed. And I truly believe that. So whether it's observing nature or observing technology or observing art, I think there are truths, there are lessons that can be brought to our world, to enterprise software sales.
You've been doing this, as we said, for three decades now. Do you think that your style has changed? And where is your style in that now, as from where it was at the beginning?
My style has changed. I think some of the things that I believe have changed. Earlier in my career, I indexed more on intelligence than I did on grit. I knew working hard was important, but I really was looking for the brilliant minds. And of course, brilliance, intelligence matters. But what I have found is that for greatness, it's more of a threshold value, meaning is one, myself, smart enough to understand the key lessons, the fundamentals required to be successful? If we clear that threshold, then the thing that really matters is how badly we want it. And so over time, I've come to realize that grit is more important than intelligence, so long as that threshold value of intelligence is met. Another thing that I've found, I vacillated. There was a time when I thought coachability was super important, and I would really look for people that craved coaching. And then what I found is that sometimes people who deeply crave coaching and direction will take it from the wrong people and end up getting pushed around. And so a customer that wants a better price or whatever, and they end up getting pushed around. And I think on the other end of the spectrum, there's individuals that are, you could say, a hardhead, that are very strong in their thinking and very committed to their thoughts. And it's very difficult for those people to evolve. And so coachability, I think, is really range bound. Yeah. You want to be coachable to where you're willing to look at yourself and willing to get better. But you also want to have some commitment to what you believe, and that'll give you strength to operate. So those are a couple of things that have changed. I think another thing that's changed is, I think if you asked me 10 years ago, I look back, say, to my time at MongoDB, I felt like I had to implement everything that I could think of right away. We had to do everything perfectly immediately. And what that misses is the importance of really fine-tuning operating rhythms.
Yeah.
And so I think something that I've discovered is that it's key to prioritize. And really, as a leader, to ask oneself, okay, what is the most important thing we need to do now? What is the most important thing we need to improve upon at this moment? And let's do it, and let's do it to a level of completeness and a level of maturity, and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because obviously, you know, we're engaging with you from a talent perspective, and we've spent some phenomenal time with some of your leaders. And I think, you know, what is really interesting is the individuals that have joined you, people like Jeff, for example, that, you know, were a CRO and now, you know, taking a step back to take an opportunity, you know, to run the West, for example. You know, why is it, do you think, that the talent are following you, you know, and making, I suppose, those sacrifices from a career perspective, join that journey and make that?
I don't know that I would characterize, I think if Jeff was sitting here and you asked him, I don't think he would characterize it as a sacrifice. I think A players want to be surrounded by A players. They yeah. want to operate in the company of others who are also talented, who are also committed to excellence. And so I think it's tempting, but a mistake to be lured by title.
Yeah.
I think that being a part of an organization that has a lot of potential, that's growing quickly, being surrounded by people who are great, who will make us better, being in an environment that's committed to growth, that operates in a meritocratic way, that's so rewarding. I think that trumps a bigger title or even bigger comp or all of that.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what you were talking about, grit, because I think it's really important. There's a lot of people that obviously watch this or listen to this podcast, and there's lots of shiny opportunities available right now. There's lots of kind of easy wins. What is grit? You know, and the reason I ask this question just before is because it does seem as though it's very easy to lose sight of what's important at different parts of your career. So if you're in that kind of growing phase of your career, what is really important? What should someone be focusing on right now more than anything else?
A good company, but most importantly, a great boss. So who you work for early in your career makes all the difference. The vast majority of what you learn, you'll learn from your boss, and the opportunities that present themselves in the future will have a lot to do with the network that you build. And so if you have a great boss, chances are that individual is hiring other great people. Yeah. And so the network you build is a network that's going to be successful. And I think it can be tempting to go for the shiny object, but often those are shortcuts, and shortcuts don't really exist in life. So go to a good company. It doesn't have to be the perfect company, because early in your career, it's about learning. It's not about necessarily is it the most star-studded company, but just go work for the best boss and be a part of the best team that you can possibly be.
How do you evaluate that boss, though? How do you know that boss has got or that manager or the leader or mentor or whatever? You know, how would our audience that's looking for that and seeking that, how would they go and assess that to ensure they're finding the right person for themselves?
There'd be a few things. If I was giving advice to my younger self, I would say, go find people that exude competence. They know what they're doing, so the things they teach me are going to be right. That appear to have a passion for developing. They're generous with their knowledge. They're happy to share their knowledge. People who genuinely care about seeing me realize my potential, are willing to invest, and will be happy to see me grow. Yeah, I think those are some of the and people who are honest.
Yeah.
Whose values are aligned with meritocracy, who are not tempted by shortcuts or quick wins.
Yeah, as another guide, there is just look at who they've helped, right?
Yeah,
do they have a genuine interest in helping others?
Yeah.
And what is those drives and what are those?
Yeah, maybe just to build on that, to the extent that you can, try to peel back and really understand what drives them. Are they doing what they're doing because they are enamored with the role, the title, ooh, CRO of blah, blah, blah? Or are they doing it because they're just trying to make money for themselves? Ooh, they want a fancy car and a fancy house. Or are they doing it because they truly love the sport, the art of sales, because they're truly committed to the people around them? I think that's what you want.
Just reflecting on some of the names, we said, you know, it's a star-studded list. It's a long, long list, and it's a big list. But is there any stories or that you reflect back on that you kind of really think fondly of?
There's a few. I guess one I'll mention is Jessica Roman. I'm a big fan of hers. She was at a company called Meltwater, which, if you're familiar with Meltwater, they're in the marketing automation space. Their deals are small. They're a company that's known for great PG. They're a hustling culture, but their deals are small. And I came across Jessica, and I could tell she was special. And I could tell she had tons of potential. And this was at Navan. I really wanted to bring her in, but where we needed someone was really to build enterprise. And she had never sold into large enterprises. She had never done larger deals. And at Navan, or at Meltwater, at the time when I met her, she had over 100 people in her organization. And the role that I needed to fill was a first line manager out west. And I think we might have had one or two salespeople there. And it was during COVID. We had a lot of our interviews were outdoors in parks. But she ultimately joined, and she learned enterprise. She learned how to recruit enterprise account execs. She ultimately thrived, and today she's running enterprise at Navan. And so she's somebody that had a lot of potential. She didn't have the knowledge, but she believed in herself, and she was willing to do the work. And I'm so proud of her for the trajectory that she's on, and she's bound for greatness. There's more to come from her. Another great one is Matt McClernand. I remember this was back at MongoDB. We were interviewing for a first line manager, again on the West, and Matt was at a company called SoftChoice. Similar story. SoftChoice is essentially a reseller, and they do smaller deals, 10 to 20K. And Matt was a second line manager. And so I think he probably had 30 or 40 salespeople and four managers working for him. And he was interviewing for the first line manager role at MongoDB. But again, he had no experience with enterprise, and he had never sold a technical product. And so both of those gave us pause about giving him the role, but we could tell there was something very, very special about Matty. And he believed in himself enough to come in as an individual contributor. And so he came in from a second line manager to an EAE. And a few months later, he did one of the largest deals, I think probably the largest deal we'd ever done, over $5 million deal. And soon after that, he became a first line manager, and he was damn good at it, because at that point, he had learned how to sell a technical product into large enterprises, and then a second line manager. And now he's running North America at Workato, and he's also bound for greatness. People having the confidence in themselves and knowing that whatever success they've had in the past, they earned, and therefore having the confidence to put themselves into a new challenge and put themselves into a role that is on paper a lower role, but knowing that they're going into a better situation with more opportunity, better mentorship, better leadership, better enablement, and just more upside, more career upside.
Yeah, we see that time and time and time again, but it's just really interesting to reflect on case studies that you've worked with where, you know, that for those individuals have shaped their career and positioned them to where they are today. So,
Carlos, obviously you are CRO at Harness. It's well documented that you really did take your time in choosing the right opportunity. No doubt there were lots and lots of opportunities that were presented to you. Just want to understand, You've had the big exits, you've had the big events. What's your criteria when you're assessing a good opportunity? How do you assess opportunity?
So my criteria have changed. They've definitely evolved over my career. As I think you know, I took a little over a year off before Harness. I spent a year in Italy with my family, which was amazing. I went into that year in Italy with an open mind about what I was going to do next. Would I go back into an operating role? Would I become a professional investor? Would I do something completely different? And it was probably only 3 or 4 months into it, on my bike, cycling to Portofino, that it became apparent to me that, you know, outside of my family, the most fulfilling thing, the thing that brings me the most joy, is seeing people realize their potential. And I don't know a better way to do that than being an operator and supporting an environment, supporting a sales team that is at once attractive to people with high potential, that invests generously in them, that operates with meritocracy, and an environment where the company is growing, and therefore opportunities are available as soon as people are ready. That led me to think, okay, what do I really need in order to be a part of an environment that does that on as large a scale as possible? And so the conclusions that I reached were, you need four things. You need a market, but not just big, a market that's large and angry. I'll come back to that. You need a product, not just a great product, a product that's differentiated and where that differentiation is quantifiable, demonstrable, and durable. I can come back to that. You need a team that can scale. And you need values. You need values. Me, personally, I need alignment with the values of the team. So going back to the market, in the case of Harness, you know, there are 30 million developers on the planet. Companies spend, you could say, on average, $100,000 per developer per year. So there's $3 trillion being spent on writing code. Well, it turns out that about half of that money, half of developers' time, is wasted on toil. writing scripts, managing environments, building software bill of materials, the list goes on. There's all sorts of things that developers have to do outside of writing code. It turns out they don't really like to do it, but they have to do it because these activities require intimacy with the code. And so Harness is setting out to automate away engineering toil and unlock developer productivity to get them from maybe 50% of their time coding to 70 or 80% of their time, and so thus increasing developer productivity massively. Companies will pay a lot to improve their developer productivity, to improve the developer experience, and this is a market that has been around for maybe a dozen years or so, but it's entering into its second phase. The first phase of the DevOps marketplace, you saw a lot of point tools, CircleCI, LaunchDarkly, a lot of these point tools. And in many cases, these point tools brought some improvement in developer productivity. The challenge, however, is that in almost all cases, the output of one tool is the input to another tool. And so you implement one point tool, you get a 3% improvement in developer productivity. You implement the next, you get 2% more, but now you have to integrate those two tools. The third tool, oh, that one has to be integrated with the first two. And so before you know it, you have this hodgepodge of integrations based on point tools, open source, homemade tools. And so what happens is the gains in productivity get smaller and smaller, but the resources required to support these integrations get bigger and bigger. Some of these organizations might have 8 DevOps people for every 10 engineers. Imagine in sales if you had 100 salespeople and 80 people in sales ops. It wouldn't work. And so the market has realized that a point tool approach to optimizing developer productivity can only get you so far, and ultimately you hit diminishing returns. And so that's been, I'd say, the genesis or the pivot towards the second era in DevOps, which is the era of the platform. And Harness has a very strong platform. And so that's the angry part. There's no company out there that is satisfied with the status quo. Either they haven't invested in DevOps, and so they've got competitive pressures and other kinds of market pressures, or they have invested in DevOps and they're hitting these diminishing returns and their investment in DevOps is sky high. The second thing is the product. Well, Jyoti, the founder of Harness, is, I would say, an exceptional product leader. The way he's organized the company, he calls it a startup within a startup. So today we have 12 modules. Each of these modules has a head of engineering, a head of product, a head of product marketing. We do QBRs for each of the modules on a quarterly basis. Jyoti and all the execs are there. And at these QBRs, we review the roadmap, we review revenue realization, we review customer adoption, they present the roadmap for the next 90 days, and so there's a high degree of accountability, which leads to performance, but also there's an amazing level of collaboration between each of these 12 startups and the sales organization. What they end up delivering, in every single case, the bar is very high, in every single case, the product either stands above the market, it stands as the clear leader in the marketplace, or it's as good as the best thing out there, and it's completely integrated with the platform, and it can be implemented on a standalone basis. And so what that does is it enables the sales organization to go out there and be truly consultative with customers, do discovery, find where the biggest pain, where the biggest challenges are, and then present the right product. And guess what? They're going to get value out of that first product, and then it's a very natural progression to the second and the third, and the integration costs are minimal because they all reside in this platform. And so this differentiation is demonstrable. It's engineering productivity typically, or cost, and they're durable because the real differentiator that Harness brings to the market is that organization, the startup within a startup, the fact that Jyoti has been able to attract the best technical minds in the industry, and that virtuous cycle just keeps building on itself. I'd say the third criteria that I valued was the team. I don't want to be at an organization where we get traction and then all of a sudden some of the team members don't scale and we have to stop and retool. And so you've got people like Gleb Brishko, who's doing an amazing job in marketing and building a best-in-class demand gen engine. John Bonney, fantastic CFO, truly in the business, a true partner to the business. And Sri and the rest of the product and Eng organization is second to none. There's more product chops there than any company I've ever been a part of. And then lastly is the thing that really matters to me is values. Because, of course, things are going to get hard. Sooner or later, things get hard. And when things get hard, you have to be able to look to your right and look to your left and respect the people that you're with. And I've got immense respect for the team. You know, they say that a company's culture really stems from the values of its leaders. And you look at Jyoti and Jyoti's background. You know, he was the chief architect at Wiley, amazing product, was super successful after it got acquired by CA and before, and then went on to found and scale AppDynamics, which was acquired by Cisco on the eve of their IPO. And I think many of the things that he learned through those experiences, especially AppD, was he's not going to take shortcuts. Mm. He's not going to be tempted by an acquisition. He's not going to be tempted by what's easy or quick. He is single-minded, determined to build a large, independent, publicly traded company. You know, a lot of people obsess about the IPO. IPO is an event. You ask Jyoti, what's the next milestone? And he will tell you, and anyone in the company will tell you, it's the $1 billion revenue. So it took the company roughly 5 years to go from zero to 100 million, and we're on the path to go from 100 to a billion in the next 5 years. And so the right way to do something, the long-term, sustainable way to do something, that's the way we do it. And so from a values perspective, it's a beautiful thing. We're building for the long haul.
You're very, very well known for simplification. Whenever I speak to any of your team, from the likes of Jeff to John to, you know, individual contributors out on the field selling this product, you know, one of the big values that, you know, has really been brought to our attention, that you've brought to the organization, is the ability to be able to simplify some of this. Can you elaborate on some of that and what you've and how you've been able to do that?
If you understand something, you can describe it in simple terms. Albert Einstein used to say, if you can't describe something simply, you just don't understand it yet. Mm. And so you have to be, again, goes back to commitment to excellence. You have to be committed to understanding things at the foundational level. And if you do, then of course you can explain them in simple terms. You can create a journey towards sophistication that starts with sound fundamentals, and then you just build on top and build automation and build sophistication. But it just starts with understanding. I think when things seem complex, it's usually somebody's trying to take a shortcut.
So we've been speaking to some of your leaders, and they talk about Jyoti's playing to level 50 plus. Tell us a little bit about that.
In order to be our best at anything, we've got to feel challenged. Anytime we're doing something that we've done before that's quote unquote easy or familiar, it's almost impossible to put your all into it. And so I think in Jyoti's case, you know, he was CEO of AppDynamics, well above $100 million. They were acquired by Cisco, and then he had a different role. And so for him, this is, I think we're already... We're already in revenue terms almost as big as AppD was, as a CEO when he was a CEO, and he's got his sights on the $1 billion, and so new levels for Jyoti are operating as a CEO of a publicly traded company, operating as a CEO of a multi-product company, which we already are 12, as I said, and developing three or four more every single year, operating as a CEO of a billion-dollar company. For myself, I'm very proud of the work that we did at MongoDB and at Navan, at other places. I'm committed, and I believe this has the potential to be much larger than that. The market's bigger, the product is more differentiated, and so I'm playing or attempting to play at a new level, and I think that's what you've got to do in order to keep it interesting and be your best, if you've got to challenge yourself by putting yourself into a new level. And I think that's where the term level 50 is from gaming.
Yeah.
It's interesting that even at the executive level, it seems as though everyone has a focus, an area where they are trying to consistently raise their levels. That's what the level 50 plus kind of analogy refers to, is that you kind of get out of that comfort zone. Are there any things that you're working on personally, you know, on yourself, trying to develop or work on to kind of help you continue on your journey?
You know, I talked about prioritization constantly, and I would say ruthlessly prioritizing and focusing myself on the things at the very top of the list, and being okay with some things falling to the floor. I've got, you know, they say our strengths can be our weaknesses. I definitely have a bias for action, and if I see something that needs to be done, I have a tendency to jump to it. And so I'm absolutely working on focusing my time on identifying, but then working on the things that will give the organization the most scale. So that's definitely one that I'm working on. Another is creating an environment that enables people to be their best, but that is sensitive to who they are as an individual. It's suboptimal to build an organization where everyone is the same mentality, the same background, but rather I think you can really build something special when you embrace when you seek out that diversity of background, that diversity of experience, and do so in a way that you maintain a very high bar for talent and for potential, but actively seek out a diverse team that can then come up with, you know, really novel solutions to problems. So those are two areas that I'm working on.
It's great to hear that, you know, even at the levels that you're kind of operating at, you know, you are still self-reflecting and consciously developing. I want to kind of just kind of pivot slightly and go back to something we were talking previously and ask you about what your opinion is on the difference between scope and opportunity.
Opportunity is about, I think there's at least two dimensions, maybe three, to opportunity. One is, can I grow my role? Can I find myself with increasing levels of responsibility? Sure. But also, do I have the opportunity to grow as an individual, to build my skills? And then maybe the third dimension is, do I have the opportunity to build my network? The most amazing human endeavors are typically things that require many people to work on together. And so I think there's easily those three dimensions to opportunity. I think when we talk about when people talk about scope, they're really talking about the first one. It's how much responsibility, how big is the team, what's the title? That's at most one out of the three key components, and arguably the least important, frankly, because if your skills, if your knowledge, if your ability is growing, if the people that you are working with are amazing, then the organization's going to grow and the scope will come. So I think it's a bit backwards to prioritize scope.
Mm. Well, I think this is a perfect segue to talking on and around the subject of, you know, taking an organization from 100 million to an exit, right? In this case, looking most likely to be an IPO, right? What is it when you're looking at this opportunity and when you're looking at the organization, what are you evaluating, right? How do you go in there, analyze an organization and understand how and where do I prioritize my time?
It all starts with data. You have to look at the data and find, you know, sales is really like process manufacturing, where the output is deals. And the units of production are the salespeople. And everything else is there to either measure or improve or augment the productivity of your unit of production, which is that sales rep. And so if you have reliable data and you can look at the process, then you can start to see where are the challenges. Where are we not getting the conversion rates that we'd like to? Where do we have bottlenecks? And based on what the data tells you, and of course, based on the opinion of the human beings, right? You got to talk to the people that are actually doing the work. Based on, I'd say, those two inputs, you formulate a plan that says, okay, this is the thing that if we can fix this one thing now, it's going to give us the most lift. But then as soon as you fix that one thing, there'll be a next thing that's the most important. The analogy that comes to mind is like, you know, with home improvement. You get a house, and maybe you buy a house. The front yard looks nice. The backyard is a mess. You go down. You get a nice barbecue. You paint. You get a gardener, and all of a sudden, the backyard looks great. And then you look at it, and you're like, oh, you know, the front yard actually isn't up to snuff with the backyard. Now you got to improve the front yard. And so it's a journey. It's a journey towards greatness. And as the organization scales, It needs different things. Different things need to be optimized and automated.
You're well known for your strength in enablement, but that comes with building a team, mm-hmm. right? Where does the reputation, and when you're looking at enablement, how does that fit into this part of that house build?
Let's call it. You gotta love it. Right. If you don't love it, you're not going to do it. Good sales leaders have an element of therapist. You have to truly care how people around you feel, and you have to have empathy and the ability to have an emotional conversation with people. They've got to be part teacher. You've got to genuinely enjoy that feeling of knowing that somebody just learned something, that twinkle that somebody gets in their eye when they figured something out and they're like, ah, I got it. The light bulb goes off. That's gotta be fun. If it's not fun, then it'll be a grind.
Yeah, it's where enablement falls into your strategy.
It's the second of the three priorities of sales leadership. So the most important is the people. You guys know yep. the importance of recruiting great people better than anybody. But if you are effectively bringing great people with high potential into the organization, then the next most important thing is to invest in them so that potential manifests into real execution and real output. And what will end up happening is, if you recruited well and you invest generously in people, the value that they'll bring back to the organization will be outsized. It'll be much more than you ever even imagined.
Yeah, I think and another one of those pillars and from us engaging is channel and the channel ecosystem. Yeah. Obviously, for your experience at MongoDB and working and seeing the importance of channel, how important is channel within a complex organization like Harness, and what's your strategy around the channel at the moment?
This is another area where I've evolved in my thinking. Early in my career, I was at Parametric Technology at PTC, and PTC was, as an organization, as a team, we were pretty dismissive of the channel. Use them to help with procurement here and there, but we, for the most part, didn't respect the channel. And then I haven't really worked at one, but I know there are companies out there that are really channel first, channel focused, Cisco or some of the security companies. And oftentimes they're selling a commodity. They're selling something where, you can almost like outsource the whole sales process to the channel. Where I've come and where Harness is really in the middle. And what I mean by that is, we are very channel focused, and the reason is because we believe genuinely that the channel can give us incredible leverage. Whether it's the hyperscalers, which AWS and GCP, they're everywhere. They have huge organizations. They absolutely will. They have strong relationships, and so if we partner with them, they can actually often elevate us 2-3 levels in the organization. And the reason that they want to is because when companies automate their development processes, guess what? Now they can very quickly move applications from the data center into the cloud. Another key value of the hyperscalers is the ability to lubricate the transaction. They have these marketplace agreements with customers where customers have a committed spend. Well, guess what? They can use Harness to burn down that spend. Then there's the global system integrators and the regional system integrators. Hey, they oftentimes, the engineers in the account are actually employees of these system integrators. And so if they find a solution like Harness that can deliver 30 or 40% developer productivity, well, they can then go back and give their customer higher value, maybe in the form of a lower price, while improving their margin. So it's a you know, 1 + 1 = 3 scenario. And so there's a really, really strong channel play here that isn't, that is a true collaboration between our salespeople and the salespeople at the hyperscalers and the GSIs and RSIs.
It's been really interesting engaging with you on looking at that side of the organization. I think that, you know, the playbook community as a whole, with a very direct selling sales motion, you know, when it comes to channel, you know, the symbiotic relationship between those two units is being a challenge.
I used to think they were incompatible.
Right.
I used to think you couldn't have a top-notch direct sales organization and a channel that mattered. And that was wrong. And you know, where I really first discovered that was wrong was at MongoDB. We talked about people, Alan Chabra. Alan Chabra came in and he's a very smart, very hardworking, and just a really thoughtful executive. And you know, working alongside of Alan, you know, we learned together how you can build a successful OEM channel, how you can land the GSIs, which was really hard at MongoDB. You know, the world wasn't people weren't begging for a new database, I can assure you. MongoDB, I bet 20 or 25% of their business is channel sourced.
This is a whole podcast series in itself, so we won't necessarily dive too deep into the nuances of that. But I think, you know, the channel as a part of the business, as you're saying, has always been seen to, you know, I've had experience in recruiting channel people, and historically there was a stigma attached to them that they were failed salespeople. You know, they're great relationship people, but can they sell, right? And so, okay, well, they're a good person, they're hardworking, you know, they understand the product. Well, let's stick them in a channel position and see what can happen. And there are stories, you know, of, you know, those individuals really kind of being, I don't know if necessarily ostracized is the word, but you know, put to the
second
back class of the classes,
citizens.
Classes. And I think you look at, you know, how that's evolving, and you look at the talent in, you know, in the right type of organizations that are being harnessed in those organizations. It's
the
great
best
talent.
The best channel people, channel sellers that I've met typically got their start in direct sales, so they know the dynamic of getting a deal, they know the pressure of having a quota. And it's just another type of leadership. It's people who really get a buzz out of leading the salespeople at their own company, leading salespeople at the partner organization, and delivering tremendous leverage. It's a highly, highly leveraged position, and I've come to meet some amazing people in that role that are absolutely not second class citizens. They are top notch people.
Absolutely.
Just closing the loop on 100 million to IPO. What do the next 3-4 years look like? What are the next couple of years, 2-3 years look like?
Yeah, I don't obsess so much on the IPO. It's a great event. It's a milestone. It's a funding event, and it's a party. And you know, you drink some champagne, and then the next day you get back to work. So I think more about the journey towards building a billion-dollar company. And gosh, that journey, there's so many things that that need to be optimized and scaled. You know, everything from some of the things that we've talked about and some that we haven't. pipeline generation, white space analysis. You know, when you have a solution as broad as harnesses, then the ability to go in and expand your existing customers is huge. Well, that's a skill set in and of itself. The ability to do business value assessments and to really be able to identify these hypothetical business cases early in the sales cycle, more tangible business case late in the sales cycle on the back of a POV, and then a business value realization after they're a customer, and then using that to set up the next deal and you know, rinse and repeat. So there's so much that we have yet to do. We're just getting started.
Well, I think this is the point where we reflect on what we've spoken about today. Absolutely. It's been fab to get you back in the studio again. Yeah. And the place to start is to say, you know, there's a real fire in your belly, Carlos. I think you're exuding that fire right now. And having spent time with lots of the team at Harness, it's amazing how infectious that passion and that energy is. And it certainly feels as though, you know, the drum is being, there's that yeah. beat of the drum, the kind of, and everyone's on a mission, everyone is galvanized. And it's a real testament to the fact that this isn't a flash in the pan. This is something that you've consistently done decade after decade, not to kind
age
of
you.
Age you anyway.
Well, it started real before. Yeah. Yeah.
But the reality is that you've got just as much fire, you've got just as much passion, and it's amazing to see what you are building and the talent that you are bringing and how you're slowly chipping away. And I say slowly, it's pretty amazing the impact that you've had in such a short time. But fab having you on the show again. It's always a pleasure. You are a true friend to Hunts and Unicorns. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation. You guys are great.